Good morning, everyone. Brad Lyons with BWG Strategies. Appreciate you joining our Q&A with Mark Zagorski. He's CEO at DoubleVerify. It's an honor to host Mark and very excited for the conversation. Before we let Mark give a brief introduction on himself and DoubleVerify, he needs to run through BWG's bank guidelines. By participating today, Mark agrees to the following. You will not share any non-public information as covered by confidentiality agreements, and you have obtained all necessary approvals to participate in this type of interactive forum, and you are not violating any policy, regulation, or agreement by doing so. For all the clients on the line, any questions that you have for Mark, please send those into rsvp@bwgstrategy.com, and I'll table them during the course of the one-hour call here. So, Mark, to start off, let's get right into it. For those that are not familiar, why don't you just give us kind of the five-minute introduction on DoubleVerify and how you guys fit into the ever-changing Nikkei ecosystem here.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Good speaking with everyone today. So if you think about what DoubleVerify and the evolution of the business, really we emerged to create one fundamental problem between advertisers and people who sell advertising, which is trying to cut through the lack of transparency in the digital ad world by creating a safe and secure ad transaction environment in which advertisers are confident that the dollars that they spent are spent on digital ads that are viewable, that are in a fraud-free environment, that are delivered in a geography in which their product can be sold, and in a brand-safe or brand-suitable context. It's pretty simple. You know, the business evolved from the fact that, you know, we no longer live in a world in which we have 10 magazines for an advertiser to advertise in or three TV stations. We've got literally tens of millions of potential advertising placement locations in the digital world, and the distance between the buyer and the seller has only gotten further away. So DoubleVerify's drive is to ensure that we secure that transaction and that we verify ad spend across every platform and every market, across any type of media, anywhere where buyers and sellers are meeting to sell digital ad space. So it's a pretty simple premise. And the analogy I like to use is if you think about, you know, your corner store, you know, 50 years ago, where the buyers and sellers knew each other, there was an implicit agreement between the two of them that there would be a transaction that would be a faithful transaction for a product that is good. We've now fast forward to a world in which consumers go into big box stores and they don't know, you know, what they're buying, and in many cases don't know who they're buying it from. So there needs to be a secure transaction or someone who protects that transaction. In many cases, that's where the credit card companies have come from. They protect the sale. We do the same thing between buyers and sellers with digital advertising in a world in which, you know, the advertiser now has tens of millions of options to spend, and publishers have an increasing number of advertisers who want to advertise on their digital properties. So that's DV in a nutshell. The company's been around for about 10 years. We went public earlier this year in April and continue to grow at a rapid pace, both with the growth in the digital ad ecosystem and the increasing demand for advertisers to have greater clarity on where their ads are being delivered and the efficacy of their dollars that they're spending there to begin with.
Awesome. So why don't you just walk us through how COVID-19 has truly redefined your growth trajectory in 2021 and moving into 2022 and beyond. Just kind of walk us through your view on the addressable market opportunity for DoubleVerify here.
Yeah. So, you know, COVID has been an interesting, you know, obviously change in the landscape on many different fronts. But for us, it's been part of the larger story of the changing way in which consumers engage with digital media, right? And that has only grown as people have become, spent more time in front of their PCs, right? More time with their digital phones, more time in front of connected televisions, which means more and more opportunities for digital advertisers, which just creates a bigger digital advertising pie. And one thing to note about DV is our solution, our verification solution, is not tied to a single type of digital media. We measure across connected television, across mobile, across in-app, across social, across mobile web. So basically any place where an advertiser chooses to spend dollars across the digital ecosystem, we are verifying that transaction and ensuring that ads spent there are valid. So as the digital ad ecosystem continues to grow, as people engage with more digital media and more of that digital media is ad supported, you know, even in areas like connected television, we see the opportunities for our business continue to grow. That aligned with the fact that not only is digital advertising growing, but the concern for advertisers around everything that's going on in the world regarding social issues, regarding, you know, sensitive political topics, that has become a third rail issue for many advertisers. So where they advertise has become just as important as what that advertising says. And we provide transparency, clarity, and protection around ensuring that where that ad shows up is not only brand safe, but brand aligned. And we call, you know, brand sensitive. It's sensitive to what the sensibilities of what those brands are all about. So we've seen the changes that have happened, not just because of COVID, but the increasing focus on brand sensitivity of where ads are delivered have been both, you know, drivers, and, you know, solid tailwinds into continued growth in our business.
Yeah, I presume your 3 to 5 year growth estimates were much different pre-COVID to today. So just walk us through how much of a pull forward that's truly been for your business, and directionally from what you've seen kind of over the last 18 months, how has advertiser and publisher investment in these types of solutions kind of ebbed and flowed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing that's important to note about our business is you know, we are a you know, software and, you know, analytics platform that works with advertisers. And we are, you know, measuring ad spend. But unlike most ad-driven businesses, we are a fixed fee or a fixed CPM business that CPM is tied to volume, not rate. So we don't take a percentage of the media transaction. So fluctuations in CPMs, so cost of an ad or, you know, the supply-demand flow of ads does not have a significant impact on our business because we work off volume, not off rate. So, for example, when you saw in 2020 a pretty massive deceleration in the advertising space in Q2 and rolling into Q3 because of COVID impacts, a lot of that impact was not the fact that people were watching less connected television or not sitting in front of their mobile phones, you know, engaging with content. It was the fact there was less demand for the advertising space because advertisers pulled back. However, advertisers pulled back, which meant the supply-demand dynamic changed and CPMs went down. So the cost of what they'd spent for those impressions went down. But the number of impressions remained the same for the most part, right? They still need to be filled. They're just getting filled at a lower rate. For DV, because our business runs on a fixed fee per transaction, we did not see even close to the kind of impact of the supply-demand change that other companies saw in the ad space because we still saw a huge amount of impressions that we had to verify. They're lower-cost impressions, but to us it didn't really matter because we charge the same fee to verify that transaction, whether it's a, you know, a $20 CPM or a $10 CPM for the most part. And that meant in 2020, you know, we were still growing at double-digit rates during COVID, whereas a lot of the industry, a lot of the digital industry, you know, was shrinking. So at the end of the day, you know, we have a strong, you know, up-to-the-right trajectory of the business based on the continued volume growth that we see in digital advertising, less impact to the dynamics of pricing, and more based on the fact that if you think of our key growth drivers, they're really focused on the core tailwind of the digital ad pie growing, so just more impressions being bought, our ability to continue to scale into new sectors as new emerging digital ad sectors grow, things like audio, growing areas like social where emerging platforms like TikTok continue to take up a significant amount of airtime. So the sectors grow. We still have a significant amount of geographic growth. So right now, over 80% and or around 80% of our business is in the Americas, which means there's a significant amount of growth outside of the U.S. And as we grow the different types of metrics that we can sell into our 1,000 customers that we work with. So we talk a lot about brand safety and brand suitability. You know, the business started off looking at brand safety, but has also now added metrics around viewability, around geography, around fraud, and all of those are continued upsells to our clients. So our long-term growth trajectory is not just driven by the tailwinds of the industry and, you know, changing focus on brand suitability and brand safety, but also on our ability to continue to verify on emerging platforms, our geographic expansion, and also our ability to upsell additional solutions to our current client base of over 1,000 global brands.
Got it. How has the rate of ad fraud then evolved across the different media types that you guys work with? Digital, CTV, you mentioned audio. Kind of walk us through kind of the trailing six-month trend and what represents the greatest opportunity moving into 22 and beyond.
So, you know, the interesting thing about fraud and what we say is like, you know, it may move from platform to platform. So we've talked a lot recently about connected TV and the growth of fraudulent impressions in connected TV. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of the same schemes. So the same type of schemes that we saw in, for example, display advertising 6 or 7 years ago, we saw later on in mobile. And then the same types of things that we saw in mobile are now what we're seeing emerging in CTV. So, you know, the analogy we always use is, you know, people still are still robbing banks. And they rob them pretty much the same way they always have. They walk in and they, you know, ask the teller for money and they try to steal it, right? What's happening now, and we talk a lot about CTV fraud, is now that they have a choice of, hey, there's a bank that only trades in $100 bills and there's a bank that has dollar bills. Which bank do I want to rob? And since CTV CPMs are significantly higher than display CPMs, so, you know, display or, you know, a banner ad may sell for $1, a CTV ad may sell for $25, we see a lot of fraud being targeted towards CTV. And these are schemes like fake apps. So, you know, fraudulent apps that may make it into an application store where someone downloads it onto their CTV. We recently uncovered a scheme called Smokescreen, in which applications were running in the background of televisions that had actually been shut off. And what had happened is, even when you shut your TV off or the application was closed, ads were running in the background of people's sets. So there's lots of different schemes out there that we continue to come up with. It's a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole. You know, once we find one, there's another one that grows. But at the end of the day, you know, in collaboration with the publishers that we work with, you know, with you know, continued focus from the advertisers who want to be insured, you know, ensure that they're not spending money on fraud, you know, we continue to root this out and press towards, you know, creating a greater level of confidence in every place they buy. And, you know, the nice part of it is, for example, even the scheme that we talked about recently, Smokescreen, which, it's still, in many cases, you know, taking millions of dollars away in the legitimate advertising spend. You know, our customers are protected from that. And that's a key part of our value prop, is we do protect our customers from fraud every day that they use us.
Got it. Obviously, there's a ton of solutions out there. How should investors be thinking about DoubleVerify's competitive positioning relative to Integral Ad Science, Moat, and others? What's kind of your core value proposition today?
Yeah, so I'll challenge the fact that there are a ton of competitors out there, because there really aren't. As with any kind of software business, you've seen a consolidation of point solutions into platforms, because advertisers don't want to work with 15 point solutions who may only verify a single type of media or a single sector of the market or cover a certain geography, right? Our clients are enterprises like Unilever, like Mondelez, that are global in nature, and they want a single platform that can measure and verify across every market, across every type of media they buy, whether it's programmatic or direct, across every different type of ad placement, whether it's a CTV, a social ad, et cetera. So the first thing is that the competitive set is actually quite small. There's really two players in the space, with a third that continues to fade. So it's us and a company called IAS. Moat, which was acquired by Oracle, you know, has continued to kind of lag in product investment and product development. We see less and less of them in the marketplace. But at the end of the day, you know, it is a, you know, I would say it's a two-horse race, but, you know, since I'm the CEO, I think there's one thoroughbred and there's one that's trying to catch up. You know, we believe that we've got a strong position versus IAS with regard to a great technology product. We know that that technology product provides more granular data that helps drive better decisions and ultimately a better client ROI. You know, when we look at our 108 logo wins so far this year, about 40% of them have been competitive takeaways. The rest have been all greenfield wins. And the company hasn't lost a top 100 client in the last 12 months. So we know we're taking market share. And the reason why that's important, not only, you know, based on the fact that, you know, I've said there's this framework around the competitive space that says you kind of have to be big because clients, you know, don't want to work with small platforms. But as you get bigger, as the company gets bigger, as we see more data transactions, think of what we analyze and verify in a smart engine. As more data goes into that engine, we get smarter. In the same way, search engines, when they first launched, got smarter as people did more searches. And as people did more searches, they got more data. As they had more data, those engines got smarter and people used them because they were better. We see that the same in the verification business. As we see more transactions, as we get more clients, we become smarter. That means we can deliver better results. That means when we go into an RFP process against a competitor, those better results will help us win that client, and it snowballs. So it's this flywheel that says more clients give more data gives better results give you more clients give you more data, et cetera. So we do believe that the momentum behind the company, based on the efficacy of our platform, the current win ratio that we know we have in the marketplace, will continue to spin us through this flywheel and not only position us as a strong, you know, one versus two, but allow us to start lapping the competitors as well. We know we've got competitive momentum right now. We know we're winning market share, and I think that will only help us in the future.
Got it. So you said 40% of net new business are competitive wins. What would you drill down to being the key 3 to 4 reasons why you get those wins? And is a large portion of this from IAS, or is it more from Moat and other smaller vendors?
To date, a large percentage of that has been from IAS. It boils down to, it's always technology first. This is an RFP process in which we go head-to-head against other competitive platforms. And there is a checkbox part of any RFP process, which everyone in the software space knows, do you provide these solutions? And then there's an implementation process. And most advertisers will actually do a head-to-head test between systems. And in those head-to-head tests, they will look for a couple key things. A, which system provides the level of granularity that I need to be able to make the decisions I want to make with my ad spend. So, for example, DV maps 75 different categories of content for brand suitability with 3 different levels of sensitivity within each of those, right? So we provide a huge matrix of brand sensitivity granularity that advertisers can measure against. That's the first thing that they do in a bake-off. The second is, what level of control do I have and what level of transparency do I have when I get this data? So it's, what level of granularity does it come in? What level of control does the system give me so that I can make these decisions? And the third is, what's the output? So what is the output when I get into a head-to-head competition? Are we filtering out more fraud because it's more granular? Am I able to actually target and measure at a more specific basis so that I can actually filter out more fraud? And we have, through our Pinnacle system, the ability to show what percentage of impressions were blocked because they weren't considered authentic based on the client's parameters. That is a direct ROI equation. So they can say, if I ran a $10 million campaign and 7% of those impressions were blocked, then $700,000 of spend was not wasted on impressions that could be unbrand safe for me, that could end up on white supremacist content or pornography, that were not in a geography for some, where someone could buy my product, so it's a wasted impression that's not viewable by a human being, or is could be potentially fraudulent. So at the end of the day, once they go through this process, it's really what ROI are we driving to the platform? And we know at the end, you know, we are driving exceptional ROI for our clients. That's why we have an incredibly sticky track record with them. If you look at, you know, our top 25 clients, the average tenure is 6.8 years. Top 75 clients, you know, 5.6 years. And, you know, that means once we get in with a client, they stick with us. And, you know, we've talked about our gross revenue retention of over 95%, a net dollar retention of over 120%. I mean, this is because we know once we get our software in, we win based on the software. We stick because of the service, and we stay forever because we drive ROI. And so, you know, we know that all of this equates to not just growth by growing horizontally and adding new clients, but growing with our clients over time and showing strong organic growth from same-store sales.
Got it. So that's a good segue into my next question here. Why don't you just give us kind of the full rundown on the adoption outlook for DoubleVerify's core product set? What is the TAM for each of your key segments, and where are the upsell and cross-sell opportunities within the existing base?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got, if you think about where when we kind of break out our revenue, and it roughly breaks into our product segments as well, is we've got programmatic, which we call which is what our pre-bid business is, which is, to take a step back, when we look at an ad transaction, there's two ways we measure it. The first is what we call pre-bid, and we work with DSPs and other programmatic platforms to actually stop that advertiser from bidding on an impression that doesn't align with their brand safety or viewability or geographic consideration. So that's what we call pre-bid. It's programmatic part of our business. It's where the advertiser calls us from a platform like a Trade Desk or a Google or an Amazon. We return back the metric that says bid or no bid, and in exchange for that, you know, we get paid for that data. The other part of our business, which is what we call direct, is when after an advertiser buys a direct impression, for example, on a CTV application or a social network, we're actually able to measure that the transaction. So we measure and verify the transaction. And in many cases, that's where we can actually block the delivery of an ad that doesn't align with the certain criteria the advertiser has. So think of the two main buckets of our business being pre-bid or programmatic and post-bid, which is what we call direct on the different networks. We've seen different growth trajectories for all of them, but, you know, at the end of the day, the growth trajectories for each of those areas is pretty strong. Year to date, we've seen a programmatic growth rate or a pre-bid growth rate of 50%, right? So, you know, pretty strong. When we look at our direct business, and the two biggest parts of our direct business are CTV and social. The CTV side, we've grown 65% year to date. Social, on a volume basis, social has grown 91% year to date. And, you know, so strong sector growth, strong product growth. And when we look at product introduction over time, on that programmatic front, the product that we launched most recently, our most recent pre-bid product that falls in programmatic, is a product called Authentic Brand Safety. And ABS so far this year has grown at 93%. And ABS is our premium pre-bid product. It's been an exceptional success story. Programmatic in itself for us now makes up about half of our revenue. And that's half of our revenue, and really programmatic, the basic programmatic solutions were launched in late 2017. So it's really been around for a little bit over 3 years, and now it makes up, you know, over $150 million of expected revenue this year. And of that programmatic revenue, about half of it now is ABS, a product that was just launched in the last launched in the last couple of years, but really started gaining traction in the last few quarters. So we see a strong growth trajectory in our pre-bid products, still with continued adoption of ABS on the programmatic side. And then on the direct side, we've got a new product which we introduced this year called Authentic Tension, which we think will have a nice long runway on the direct side and actually measuring tension and engagement across multiple different platforms, both on direct publisher platforms and eventually into connected television. That is in the early stages of introduction, but we know that continued growth in social and CTV will drive that as well. And, you know, I think these are all big opportunities for us when we talk about those growth drivers is, you know, continuing to launch new products across new sectors is that layering that we have with core customers to continue to upsell them new solutions.
Got it. What percent of your existing client base would you say is in a position to be upsold?
The nice part is that, you know, as we layer on new solutions, so for example, we just acquired a company called OpenSlate. OpenSlate does pre-bid, what we just noted is pre-bid campaign targeting and filtering for the non-programmatic world. That is an entirely new solution in our basket of goods. They have an overlap of 60 clients with us, and we work with 1,000 different brands. So we've got significant upsell opportunities for that solution. Products like Authentic Attention and Contextual Targeting, which are brand new, are probably used by less than 5% of our current client base. So those are new right out of the gate. We've got huge opportunity to upsell those clients and those products as well. And we've seen when we have an effective solution that fits nicely into our suite, what the upsell can be with programmatic, right? Again, we launched our programmatic solutions, a little bit over three years ago. And today, almost the entirety of our top 100 clients use us for both direct and post-bid measurement and programmatic and pre-bid measurement. So when we look at what the available universe is of upselling new products and new solutions, I mean, it's 100% of our current client base. We know that, there will probably be some percentage that we won't sell, but based on the success of our programmatic and pre-bid solution, which is half of our business, think of it, just roughly do the math, half of our business is now programmatic and pre-bid, half is post-bid. We were a post-bid only company 3 years ago, 3 to 4 years ago, and now we have another solution. So we pretty much have sold, a significant number of our clients, pre-bid. So that plus new solutions plus our ability to actually add new clients, every one of those clients now becomes a pre-bid and post-bid customer on the programmatic side. They become a post-bid customer on the direct side. And now with the acquisition of OpenSlate, we have the opportunity to now sell both all new clients and our current client set of over 1,000 brands a pre-bid filtering solution as well.
Very interesting. So as we all know, 2022 will have some large growth comp hurdles. How do you think about the growth rates of the buckets you outlined, CTV, social, go down the list?
Yeah, I mean, look, we think there's still really strong momentum in all of the core breakout areas. You know, programmatic continues to grow. And interestingly enough, programmatic and CTV become more intrinsically linked with the success of people like The Trade Desk moving more connected television transactions into the programmatic realm. That's great for us because we know that programmatic is a wonderful way of buying massive amounts of inventory at a very efficient rate through an automated system, but it also lacks transparency, right? And our core driver is to create transparency in that transaction, hence the need for verification solutions and programmatic platforms. So we see growth in programmatic as well as growth in CTV as being strong drivers for us that we'll continue to see double-digit growth from moving into 2022. Social continues to be a boomer. And I think we'll continue to see, easily see double-digit growth coming out of social based on the fact that not only do we see volumes increasing into the platforms we cover, like Twitter, Facebook, and others, but emerging platforms like TikTok, which have over a billion monthly users, is an area where we've just launched products against, right? And we're going to continue to iterate on products as well across the TikTok platform as that gains more advertiser momentum. So across social, across CTV, across programmatic, we see all of them moving into continued double-digit growth for the foreseeable future.
Got it. Another perfect segue there, but yesterday Facebook posted a blog that suggested they will work with third parties for brand safety on its news feed. What are your thoughts on this? What kind of opportunities does this create for DoubleVerify?
Yeah, no, it's pretty exciting news and pretty timely. And we're trying to temper some level of enthusiasm, but at the end of the day, it's a big deal. Having third parties, participate in that brand safety and brand suitability aspect of Facebook is a giant meatball. I don't know how else to put it. It's a big opportunity. Right now, we work with Facebook on the post-bid side, right? So, not in a pre-bid function, but on the post-bid side, but only doing viewability and fraud, right? And some level of brand safety across the watch business. We know watch is very, very small, and we know the news feed is the crown jewel, and we know that every single one of our advertisers that works with us on Facebook, either evaluating post-bid viewability or fraud or impression counting, has been desperate for third parties to get involved with Facebook in the news feed. So we think it's a pretty substantial opportunity. We know social right now, we've talked about this, about 7.5% of our total revenue is on Facebook. And that 7.5% looking at a very, very small portion of Facebook, probably, less than 10 to 15% of the the actual ad transactions that go there. So, you can take multiples against that number to say, this is a big opportunity for us. It's all potential. Nothing is confirmed. Nothing is committed. This is still very early in the Facebook process. But we think it's a interesting and pretty sizable opportunity if we're, engaged to participate in that as well. So it's something we've talked about for a while. We think the relationship with Facebook has been really outstanding to date. They've been great partners, and their willingness to open up to third parties to evaluate what's going on their site is a great sign for them. It's a great sign for advertisers, and certainly is a great potential sign for DV as well.
Got it. Just directionally, where do you think that 7.5% of total revenue generated from Facebook could go on the heels of this news then?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's pretty early to say, and I wouldn't want to put a number out there until we really got into it, but it's sizable, right? It's multiples against that number if things go the right way. So it's not a percentage increase. It's a exponential increase.
Awesome. Why don't you give us kind of your current thoughts around recent and future privacy regulations? Obviously, IDFA, iOS 14.5, and then Google cookies coming sometime in the future here. How do both of those positively or negatively impact DoubleVerify's business?
Yeah. So we've been always pretty transparent on the fact that from a mechanics perspective, our system doesn't rely on cookies. It doesn't rely on individual identifiers like IDFAs, and is inherently, privacy friendly because of the fact that we don't look at the who. We look at the what. We look at the how. And we look at the where. What happened in that transaction, how that ad was delivered, and where it ended up, what the context of the page was. So from a mechanics perspective, we have seen minimal, and we'll continue to see minimal impact on our business because from the deprecation of cookies, from the obfuscation of IDFAs, from all of those things, because we don't run off of them. So it's not a raw material that our system uses to deliver its product. So that's the first part. On the positive side, so it's neutral from a mechanics perspective, but it's an opportunity from a strategic perspective, because as it gets harder to track a consumer from platform to platform, from place to place, as privacy rules start to press in on even first-party data usage and the ability to use it to target individuals or to determine reach criteria against reach and frequency and age and gender, things like context, metrics like attention become increasingly important to advertisers who are trying to bridge that gap between what they spend and how they drove an outcome. And if you think about it, you know, for a very long time, and particularly in digital, it's always been about, let me get reach and frequency against a certain audience, and let me target a specific individual to try to drive an action. If that becomes increasingly difficult to do, they're going to look for other opportunities or other metrics to help drive that outcome. So we know that context, you know, people say content is king. We like to think context is king, right? It's where that ad shows up can have a direct impact on the efficacy of that ad. We believe that attention, a metric that we are first to market with, one that we are advancing, you know, across and getting adoption with our clients, is going to be a key indicator and a key driver of performance. Not just who saw the ad, but how big that ad was on a page, what was the competitive environment around it, how long did it play for, was there any type of engagement or mouse rollover on it? All of those things are critically important to actually showing, did it have an impact on the user? Did it change someone's hearts and minds? And did it actually help drive a sale? So that's a very long answer to, you know, at the end of the day, we look at the ongoing privacy pressure that's happening to the digital ad space, the, you know, increasingly challenged, you know, individual level identifiers, all of those providing opportunities for what we traffic in. And that's data on the context of the page, that's data on the engagement of your page, and it's about all of those other things around advertising that don't have to do with the who and that are not connected to individual identifiers. So we think it's a great opportunity for us.
Got it. You highlighted at the front revenue concentration within the U.S. Why don't you walk us through your Meetrix acquisition, the synergies there, and how that will help you drive international growth?
Sure. So, candidly, we were a bit late to the game on a international expansion front. You know, we just started opening offices outside the U.S. in 2018. But we know that there's a huge amount of opportunity out there. So, you know, 20% of our business is currently outside the U.S., I think one of our competitors stated that 40% of their business was outside the U.S. So we think there's not only a great competitive takeaway opportunity for us, but also a significant amount of white space where we just haven't invested in people against. Both the Meetrix acquisition and our people investments so far year to date are kind of a testament to our belief that, you know, there's value in investing outside the U.S. because of the great opportunities there. So our headcount to date, 55% of the new headcount that we brought on this year at DB has been outside of the Americas. Almost 40% of our staff now is outside of the Americas. And the Meetrix acquisition was a good example of how we look at, you know, expanding outside of our core. And we're going to do so by, you know, putting people on the ground. And those people are generally sales and client support. So we don't need engineering on the ground. We don't need product development on the ground in any markets because, you know, we are both cloud and data. We can deliver our product anywhere in the world pretty seamlessly. We're going to put people on the ground, but we're also going to look for really smart acquisitions where we can bring regional clients into our global tool set and bring regional expertise. And that's what Meetrix really was. It was the opportunity for us to create a great team of local experts in Germany and in Eastern Europe, as well as the Russian markets, So our ability to, you know, get great resources there, a solid customer base, in-place customer base of over 80 clients, right, in markets where we didn't have a significant penetration. So it allows us to kind of take our platform, roll it into that market where Matrix has been strong, take a point solution out of the market, a regional point solution, and then allow us to expand, you know, more aggressively, you know, in the places they play. So we do think the international opportunity for us is strong. We said before, you know, our growth outside of the Americas has been over 60% so far this year, and we think there's continued momentum there. Mostly due to the fact that, you know, a lot of these markets are starting to, you know, experience the same types of challenges that the U.S. market has been around brand suitability, around brand safety, around concerns around fraud. So, you know, big opportunity outside the U.S. Matrix plays a really key role in helping kind of firmly establish us as a strong player in the European market. And I think there could be more opportunities for us down the road in places like APAC and others on the acquisition side where, you know, these tuck-ins of, you know, I don't want to say an acqui-hire, but kind of regional expansion capabilities is kind of a quick way for us to take our platform, introduce it to a market with a pretty low overhead basis and a good already ingrained client set.
Got it. Now, the Matrix acquisition, I mean, was that primarily driven to just drive geographical reach, or did it solve any product holes?
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, they definitely have a strong engineering team, and it's always great to get some engineers. In today's market, they're incredibly expensive and very tough to bring on. So we've got a great series of people assets, but really it was focused on geographic expansion. And when we look at our M&A strategy, we've got three, main drivers of what we look at. The first is, does it help us expand globally? And I think Matrix fell directly into that bucket. The second is, does it accelerate our product roadmap? Does it help us do something faster on the product side than we could do on our own? And the third is, does it give us an entirely new product or a new product capability that we can upsell our clients immediately? And I think that, you know, is really what, when we think about our most recent acquisition of OpenSlate, you know, Matrix really checked the box in the first one, which gave us geographic expansion. We can now move our platform into there and our expertise into there to work with their people to continue to sell. But OpenSlate really is the last two, which is helping accelerate our product roadmap in an area which we wanted to go into anyways, which is pre-bid or pre-campaign targeting for, direct buys, as well as give us a brand new product in our basket of goods to go out and sell our increasingly large customer base.
Awesome. I have a few follow-up questions that came in regarding the Facebook newsfeed. Are others like IAS involved in that opportunity, or is it just DV? And then is this for brand safety, or does it encapsulate ad fraud and viewability as well?
The Facebook opportunity is still very, it's very nascent. The announcement just came out yesterday, or 2 days ago, yesterday. It was very, very recent, yesterday. It's still new. It's an RFP process. So they will be inviting, several companies to take a look at, the opportunity as well. It is for brand safety and brand suitability on the news feed. There are, companies like DV are already working with Facebook on viewability and fraud in the news feed. So doing, post-bid measurement across that. But this is the holy grail. Like, this is the big one. This is what our advertisers are really looking for. And I think that's why it's generating so much excitement, because not only are they bringing third parties in, they are doing so in a place that is, a big part of, their volume, and it is, the crown jewel. So that's exciting for us. Whether or not they work with multiple companies, whether or not they work with, competitive companies, that's still left to be determined. But we believe that we will probably be part of that scheme in one way or the other, just due to the fact that we have a relationship. Can't commit to anything, nothing beyond what really is in the announcement has been known to anybody, so it's still very early days.
Awesome. As a reminder, we're going to wrap up here in 10 minutes. So any final questions that you have for Mark, send us into rsvp@vgstrategy.com. But Mark, as everyone's aware, you guys did a secondary offering. Why don't you just walk us through the primary uses of those funds? Was it to pay for OpenSlate or something else?
No, the secondary was all, there was no primary shares. So it was Providence Equity, who was our PE holder, or it was our PE backer, had sold secondary shares. No company shares were issued. It was a secondary sale. They still are a considerable shareholder of the company. So I think even after this, they're at a, you know, they still own a majority stake of the business. So this is just the normal course of them starting to wind off a bit of their holdings, but they're still, and I think they're still either at 50% or slightly around that zone. You know, it's important to note, just even after the OpenSlate and Matrix acquisition, we have, you know, over, you know, $200 million of cash and no debt, and we're a cash-driving machine, so we throw off a significant amount of cash as a company. So we are in really strong position to not only continue to invest in the business, but look at strategic acquisitions down the road. I mean, this is a company that, again, is profitable, throws off cash, has cash from the IPO still in the bank, a significant amount of it, and has zero debt. So the amount of leverage we have to actually go out and build a business is pretty extraordinary.
What parts of the stack are truly missing today? Like, where could be the nice addition when you take a look at DV today and in the future?
I think, you know, there's when we think about kind of, I wouldn't say gaps, but opportunities for us, it's less in the stack and more in coverage and extension, right? So at the end of the day, I think there's opportunities for us to cover more different types of media. We've barely scratched the surface in audio. There's opportunities in gaming. Expanding that coverage sometimes can come in the form of an acquisition, right? Or a development. You know, we can either develop or find companies that are, you know, specializing in verifying transactions on those platforms. So I think that's, you know, that's the first bucket is, you know, sector, you know, what can help us expand from a sector perspective. And then I think there are entirely new metrics that we're going to continue to invest in that enhance our core authentic ad. And I think that's where authentic attention comes in as well. So it's less of a gap than it is, again, an extension of our authentic ad into authentic attention, extension of our authentic ad into new sectors. And then I think the third part of that would be extension of our pre-bid business that we currently have in the programmatic space into a pre-bid or a pre-campaign filtering into direct buys. And that's really the gap that we filled with OpenSlate, which is our ability to do pre-campaign or pre-bid filtering and targeting in direct, you know, non-programmatic venues. So, you know, again, we think of everything as continued extension from our core, continued coverage, and then, you know, additional, you know, pieces that help enhance the advertiser experience on every different platform they advertise against.
Got it. Always like asking this question. What do you believe are the most misunderstood things about DoubleVerify's business today, and how would you kind of address those?
Yeah, I think, you know, the one thing that we always like to hammer home in, you know, folks who are not super deep into ad tech or, you know, are but have really experienced more the media side of the business is that, you know, DV is a utility. We're a utility that when we get in with a brand, they more or less use us on every impression that they buy on every different type of media that we cover. So, you know, we always use the seatbelt analogy. It's kind of like, you know, you don't get in your car one morning and say, yeah, traffic looks kind of light. You know, I'm just going to go without a seatbelt today and risk it. You know, our advertisers don't pick and choose campaigns that they use our solution on. For the most part, they use it on every impression that we measure against. And that's critical to note because the ebbs and flows in ad spend or share of wallet, those types of discussions don't have a huge impact on our business. We don't get a share of wallet from a client. It's a software sale that the advertiser goes in and chooses a platform. And that platform form for the most part usually is implemented across all the impressions that they have. In the same way a company would implement Salesforce and wouldn't say, well, you know, the division that sells widgets versus the division that sells, you know, screws, one division uses Salesforce and the other one decides not to use Salesforce, but it all rolls up to the same CRO. It doesn't work that way. So at the end of the day, you know, we are definitely seen more as a utility, and that creates a broader, you know, case of stickiness. But it's a utility that has the magic of not being tied to a fixed monthly fee. We enjoy the volume growth opportunities that are found in the advertising space without having the share of wallet battles that most advertising or advertising technology companies have to play in. So it's a big differentiator for us. It is, you know, a universe in which we believe that there are not multiple winners. There are, you know, there are a very small handful of companies that will matter. And as the world continues to consolidate into platforms, we think we're in an exceptional position to be one of the platforms it consolidates into.
Got it. Last one for you, and then we'll wrap up after this. What are the true wild cards to monitor? What are some things that people should be keeping an eye on moving into 2022?
You've brought up a couple of them in the call already, which is, you know, what happens around, you know, identifiers and individual level tracking and privacy. Those have a broader impact not only on, you know, where digital ads go, but also have a more micro impact on, you know, our business and dollars that will flow into things like context and attention. So I think from a macro perspective, that's important. I think the continued growth in social interactions across platforms, both from a consumer engagement perspective, but also more importantly from an advertiser perspective, I think are, again, both macro issues, but ones that impact DV in a very positive way as, you know, our ability to cover more social platforms, to engage with more social platforms, to verify transactions for advertisers who are just dipping their toes into areas like TikTok. I think is something to watch. And then I'd say finally, you know, the broader global awareness of advertiser brand safety and brand suitability. You know, we talked a lot about the U.S. and it's the majority of our business, but as we've also mentioned, you know, we believe there's a huge opportunity outside of the U.S. And part of that is because the increasing level of brand sensitivity and around context, around certain types of incendiary content, and that advertisers drive to stay away from things that are not suitable or aligned with who they are as a brand. You know, those are macro issues and macro drivers of digital ad spend that also, you know, have a very positive impact on DV.
Awesome. Let's wrap it up there. Really appreciate you doing the call, Mark. Any investors that have follow-up questions, feel free to reach out to the Double Verify's investor relations team on their website, and I'm sure they would be in touch. Have a good weekend and upcoming holidays. Thanks again, Mark.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.